Hello and welcome to Dateline New Haven. I'm your host, Paul Bass, inviting you to look behind the headlines on the stories that make New Haven tick. And who makes New Haven tick more than Mayor Tony Harp, who's here in the studio for her weekly Mayor Monday checkup on what she and we are up to in New Haven. Good morning, Mayor Harp.
Good morning.
Hey, what a great day out.
It's gorgeous.
We got to bottle this. Maybe we'll have a longer. I mean, I feel bad for Houston, but we're getting nice weather.
Yeah. So far, so good.
And you can join the conversation by posting a question on our Facebook page, New Haven Independent Facebook page, where we have the Facebook Live broadcast of the show. And you can call us in at 203-872-ELM, 203-872-7356. Today's program is made possible in part thanks to support from Birch and Moses PC and from Gateway Community College in downtown New Haven. Thanks, Gateway. Thanks, Bertram. Thanks, Mayor Harp, for stopping by. Hey, so we're not your first stop today. You were up early for the first day of school. You're not going to school, are you?
Well, I went to school this morning.
I saw you. People saw you outside John C. Daniels School in the Hill.
Yeah, it was great.
You enrolling or what was up?
Well, we wanted to welcome all the kids back to school, and it was great to welcome the new principal. So it was a lot of fun. The superintendent was there. A lot of the educational hierarchy were there, and it was really parents were there, as a matter of fact, and it was
so
wonderful.
What was it like when you greeted people? What did people say? What was the mood?
Oh, everybody was kind of excited. The kids were really excited because we clapped for them, we shook their hands, we told them to have a great year, and we had nothing but smiles and giggles.
I think I said John Daniels, when he was mayor, he got to the point where being around a lot of grown-ups made him nervous because everybody wanted something from him.
Yeah.
And he was kind of uptight. But the second he got into a school and he was around a kid, he was just like relaxed and happy. And he felt like that was the good part of the job.
Oh, yeah. The kids are wonderful. They really are. So I get it.
Now, when you do an event like that, do you have time to have conversations with parents? Or is it more like just sending the message, we care what happens this year, we want to get off to a good start, that kind of thing?
I actually had some conversation from two very interesting parents. They both live in Orange, and they were so high on John C. Daniels School. As a matter of fact, the gentleman said that from the time that he knew he was having a child, before the child was born, he was trying to figure out how he could get his child into John C. Daniels.
Wow. How did that happen? Like, what had he heard? He must have known somebody.
It's a dual language school.
What are the two languages? English, Spanish?
Yes. And so he wanted to make sure that his child was conversant in both language, could read it, could write it. And he felt that the best way to do that would be to go to John C. Daniels. So that's
very nice.
Yeah.
And John C. Daniels is that big. It's a really nice school.
It's very nice.
I love the way the clock, the big globe thing, this design very nicely.
Yeah.
And it symbolizes sort of the challenge of magnet schools. So the state put the money up for most of that school.
Right.
And the bargain was that forever a big chunk of the slots would go to people from the suburbs. And that as a state, we cared about having city and suburbs together in the classroom. So then when you have a good school like Daniels, then people in the city say, wait a second, this isn't our school. I pay taxes. I want my kid to go. And I live right here. And then other people say, well, it wasn't your money that built it, but it's our money that keeps running it. It's kind of tricky.
It's tricky to some extent. We do get extra money for our magnet schools from the state, as well as our regular educational cost-sharing grants. So, and, you know, oddly, because I was looking at the numbers recently, I would say 75% of what we get in, or maybe we'll put it this way, about 25% of the cost of public education comes from New Haven taxpayers.
And then so magnet schools until recently, I think, tell me if you agree with this, sort of like apple pie. Everybody said, of course you want that. I mean, the Sheff versus O'Neill school desegregation lawsuit that said magnet schools is the answer, as though in Hartford it's kind of had the reverse effect. You know, sometimes we think we're solving a problem and creating a new one. It hasn't been the same issue here, because I think magnet schools started earlier here with the Bank Street model at West Hills way back in the 70s and 80s, and that was very successful.
Very.
Mm-hmm. But is it being reexamined at all? Mike D'Agostino, state rep from Hampden, said he's kind of reexamined it. He wondered whether, first of all, there was the whole movement of people saying for re-examining the whole busing era and saying, African-American parents saying, it's not that we need our kids sitting next to the white kid. That's for his benefit from the suburbs. Although the white kids in the city, obviously, might disagree. But from the suburbs coming in, that's for their benefit for a better education. We just want to have the equal resources and just as much coming to our schools as come to suburbs. And other people say everyone benefits from having sibling in suburbs in this classroom together and having different races together in the classroom.
Well, I think it's important in a learning situation to have people who come from different backgrounds, not just different racial backgrounds, but as well different economic backgrounds, so that that you can share experiences. When you have a population and what they experience is the same day in and day out, it doesn't really expand your vision. And so I think that it's important to find ways to have a classroom that has lots of kids in it that have lots of different experiences that they can share with one another and they can learn from one another.
One theory about what school's all about, more than anything, is preparing you to be a citizen, there to function in society.
Sure, and that was one of the things that I thought was really brilliant about our founders is understanding how important a free public education is to the development of our country and certainly to the development of our future. And that was one of the things that I talked about. These young people that stay in New Haven are going to inherit New Haven, become our leaders, drive policy, define what it is we'll be in the future. So we are quite literally building our future with the work that we do with these young people.
I was talking about this with a teacher from Metro Business Academy, another magnet school. She lives in New Haven in the Hill, and she's all for this. I asked her a question. She said, you know, the kids who come to suburbs, she teaches social studies. The debates are so much better and minds are changed about life when you have the discussion with people. But that doesn't mean that you could think of it in that narrow way of does the city get screwed or not through funding and all that, that this is as much to the benefit of those suburban kids as it is for the city kid to be there. And that maybe sometimes we, when we look at policy like magnet school policy, we maybe need to think about how does society benefit as opposed to how's the city benefit versus the suburb. What I mean is that the investment we're making there helps society to have everyone in school together. It doesn't necessarily help cities being screwed by unfair funding or what was the basis of Chef versus O'Neill.
So I don't think it's the city that is getting screwed, and because I think it's sort of, again, you know, it's more the community and the whole idea of community school that, you know, has to be set aside. And so that I know there are a number of taxpayers who feel very strongly that they want their children to be able to go to a neighborhood school, be able to walk to a school. And that is really what we can't accomplish. The other thing that we've had trouble accomplishing is that we can't get siblings into the same school, so that you have a parent who has kids in maybe three different schools, depending upon how many kids, three or four, depending upon how many kids they have. And so,
and we hear about this every year. You and I hear people telling us about yes. The agony, the wrenching thing about the schools.
So I think that it's really a problem that families have. It's really hard to understand, because when we went to school, you went to the neighborhood school. And, you know, then when you say, well, we have sibling preference, but you hear time and time again that we have it, but it's also weighted against other things, and oftentimes it doesn't work out.
Because this is so emotional, because one of the issues most in public life, civic life, that tear parents is their kids' education.
Sure.
So often we're looking for villains, good guy, bad guy. But in truth, you know, and I've followed this community school versus magnet school debate for decades now.
Mm-hmm.
And I would argue it doesn't have to do with good guys or bad guys. I would argue that it has to do with just figuring out what works. And
right.
Our ideas change about that. So you just brought this up about, so on the one hand, people do believe there's such a value for being able to walk to your kid's school. And like you look at West Hills School, right? So you have people riding a bus for an hour a day each way to get there, because it's a magnet school and it has a certain focus. And you have other kids who live nearby who then have to get bused somewhere else. And that doesn't seem to make sense. It costs a lot of money for busing. It has kids on buses too long. But on the other hand, when we had this debate, I would argue when New Haven settled this question was in 2001. This was a big issue in the mayoral campaign this year. It was an honest issue that year. And Marty Luna was saying, we got to go back to community schools. Everybody go on your neighbor and just make all the schools good. And John DeStefano, the incumbent mayor, was saying, I've heard from the voters, most people like this idea of choices of type of schools. Some kids like to be able to go to a school that has a focus on dual language. Some kids like to go to a focus on science, ESOMs. And that's what the parents want. They're willing to schlep around to get them there, even though it causes all these new problems like you bring up. Like if the kids can't go both the same school, it's really hard to get them to both. But then going back, that is one way to build neighbors, to have good community schools. And some people say, you know, like I bought a house near Edgewood School and I'm 2 blocks away. Why should I have to send my kid on the bus for 45 minutes? We usually are able to accommodate those people. But I do think it's an honest debate that doesn't have to do with anybody getting something over on somebody or anybody trying to hurt the rights of another citizen. I think this is an unresolved public question that doesn't have an easy answer.
No, I think you're absolutely right. And until all of our schools are excellent, and not just good, but excellent, then it really depends even.
And there's no way around it until that happens. Like people are desperate about high school they get because the perception they have, right or wrong, about what a high school is like and where you send your kid.
I mean, it's shocking, isn't it, that one of the things the superintendent said today was that 4 young people from Hill House got in to Yale and are going to Yale. There are 360 Promise Scholars. And, you know, if you'd heard the debate about Hill House, you would have thought nobody was going to college there and that we were doing an awful job.
What I loved about that is that after that debate ended, the governor had a press conference out of Hill House to say it had made the most progress in the state. Some of the key measures they were screwing up. But now the political fight was over, so all of a sudden that didn't matter anymore. Although there were really good questions there about how do you implement school within a school and all that.
Well, exactly. But, you know, like the argument was that it somehow impacted the education of kids. It was an adult's argument about policy that probably had no real impact.
But there also was the debate how people liked the way the school was. It had other leadership before, and they were kind of holding their ground because of the change, right?
Well, they loved Kermit Carolina. And so...
Or Lonnie Garris.
Or Lonnie Garris. And in both cases, they liked having that one person that they could go to. And I can say that it was a little confusing, but I don't think it impacted the education of kids.
I happened to, Fridays ago, I was talking to one parent whose son went to Cross, did well there, lives in Westville. And a lot of Westville parents go to Cross, even though the district is Hill House. Yep. And my kids did that 2 years back. And, you know, that's part of the issue.
Well, and, you know, I mean, in all honesty, you know, like that's a bit of a ride from Westville.
Yeah, it is. And that was important enough that you want to go to school where you feel they're going to get the better AP classes and all that. Mm-hmm. So this parent's second kid didn't make Cross the first choice. If he had made Cross the first choice, he would have gotten in. But he made his first choice New Haven Academy because that's become the smoking school. I don't know if people know, but that's the sleeper hit.
Yeah.
I mean, that school has been built up to. It's just an incredibly interesting, diverse, great leadership. They do such interesting stuff with facing history in that curriculum. It really is like very few places in the country you get a curriculum like that. So he wanted to go there, but there aren't many slots. Mm-hmm. So it's not like he should have been able to go there, right? So he didn't get in. And because Cross was his second, he couldn't get into Cross, even though his brother had gone there. So he went to Hill House, and the father, who comes from a very academic family, you know, Yale Law and all that, he gets the letter that says, you know, we're going to be great at athletics and academics now at Hill House. So he sees that and panics, and he says, that says to me that's a school, that's a sports school, that's saying it's going to be good one day at academics. So he's actually paying tuition to have his kid go to Woodbridge School.
My.
I'm just thinking these are aggravating choices.
It is aggravating, and in all honesty, he should have looked at the kids that are going to, you know, Ivy League schools from Hill House. And, you know, honestly, well, not that it would matter to him because he probably can afford the tuition. He wouldn't care whether or not kids are getting college credit at Hill House, but they're getting actual college credit there. And of course, Wilbercross, too. But it started at New Haven Academy.
Yeah, that's quite a school.
Yeah.
And this is quite a day to remind you that you're listening to Mayor Mundy. WNHH Radio, your home for community radio, 103.5 FM, live, deep, newhavenindependent.org. We have gotten a text today from Bob. Bob did not call, which is a little bit of a disappointment.
It is disappointing.
I like the ritual of Bob calling and saying hello to the mayor and getting all excited about it and asking good questions. He really didn't have a long question this time. Uh-huh. Or like one that's going to put you on the spot. Please ask the mayor, and thank you for texting the Bob question. I didn't mean to insult you, Bob. Ask the mayor if New Haven is going to send aid to Houston. It's been interesting reading about the flood there. The National Weather Service said they never saw a flood like that. feet. And I also didn't know that Houston was our fourth largest city.
I knew that. I met the mayor from Houston at U.S. Conference of Mayors down in Miami. And my gosh, you know, like your mayoralty can turn on a storm. I would hate to be him having to face a storm like that that is going on for like days upon days.
And they're telling people that your attic isn't safe. You got to be on the roof.
Yeah.
And they're going to have several more days of rain coming.
I know. It's really, it's an awful thing. I my heart goes out to them. I know that our Red Cross is sending people down there to help out.
The New Haven Red Cross.
Right. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to have to check with our fire department to see if we can.
Also, I don't know, is it humans they need or do they need, I've heard boats. They need boats in Houston.
Really?
That's what the mayor and the officials there say, send boats so they can rescue people. You only got one boat. You got the Richard C. Lee, right? Might take a while to get down there. They might have, the streets might actually be visible getting Houston by the time the Richard C. Lee gets down to Houston. So you've had experience preparing for what were going to be huge storms. I'll never forget, I don't know if it's your first winter or the second, we had one that we thought was going to be as big as 2013, Snowmageddon. Do you remember that? And we were all getting prepared the day before. I was telling Markeisha, who was new, what Snowmageddon was like. Mm-hmm. And everyone was stocking up. And then it all passed us. I went out to sea at the last minute. And but you know what it's like to prepare, to get down there at the Emergency Operations Center, to get in touch with everybody who's going to be dealing with the emergency, get updates every, you know, several times a day, right, and get the word out there. The you know, it's a defining moment for a politician. I remember Ben DeLito, the mayor, his defining motion was the big flood in Westville. I believe that Donald Trump is the luckiest person in America because of the storm. Because it doesn't take a lot. Like George Bush blew it with Katrina.
Right.
But in general, it doesn't take a lot to show up, say you care, do the obvious thing you got to do about getting people in charge and getting help and appealing to everyone. I mean, it's really a gift to politics. Not that you're willing disaster in your community. You don't like that, obviously. But it is a political gift. Ella Grasso with the defining storm of when she was governor, remember the big snowstorm? Mm-hmm. And that was the modern era get ushered in when you had the live update from the governor herself at the where they had all the plows. So, I mean, I do think there's a political upside. But anyway, one thing you've been doing since you've been in is working on this flooding issue. Because we've learned even from flash floods that were just an hour that down by the train station, that becomes not quite like Houston, but actually pretty quickly, that becomes a lake.
Yeah.
So what are you doing about flooding?
Well, you know, one of the things that we've been doing is working with the Department of Transportation, the Connecticut Department of Transportation, to get their attention. We've got to expand the pipes that run under the train yards, and we've finally gotten them to agree that they're going to work with us on that. We have bioswales. I always say that around the city.
I love those bioswales. We have so many of them. You just go by like West Park Avenue and Elm Street down there. It's like every few feet there's a bioswale.
Right. And so that we've been working on
Fairhaven.
A green way in which to sort of take water off of the street with URI. And
Urban Resources Initiative, a nonprofit that plants a lot of trees. And it really teaches city kids, teenagers, to do a lot of this work, as well as people from Emerge who have been coming out of prison and they pay them. That's Emerge.
And so we're really excited because it's building a lot of green jobs in our city, and that it will take some of the pressure off of the gray infrastructure. We're also working to do sustainable coastlines, and so we've gotten money from the state to rebuild the coastline over in the East Shore, and we're thinking that that will help as well. And as you know, we are in the process of rebuilding the pier out there, and it will sustain more of those kinds of storms. In terms of snow, we've gotten a new fleet of trucks. My first year.
And by the way, there's a caller who's holding. I'm just going to tell her to keep holding while you go on, just because we have a new system and they weren't able to be told that yet. So thanks for calling 287. We'll get to you in a minute.
Okay. So, and then we have two 10-foot wide snow blowers that are just going to take the snow out of the city.
I love those buildings. I've seen those machines.
Yeah,
I've seen them when you're parading around the street in those huge, like, Snuffleupagus snouts, you know, like Sesame Street. Yeah. Okay. So 287, thanks for calling. Mayor Monday, you have a question for Mayor Hart? Hello.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
I guess you're talking to me. Hi.
Yeah, hello, you.
Hi. My name is Melinda, and hi, Mayor Harp.
Hi.
As you know, because we've been talking to you and the controller, Daryl Jones, for a while, New Haven Stands with Standing Rock has been urging the city to move its money, its operating funds, out of Wells Fargo Bank. And we know that you didn't invest the money in the bank when it was Wells Fargo, but it is Wells Fargo now. And we've been conducting, you know, face-to-face petition gathering, and literally at least half the people we've asked to sign the petition, as soon as we say Wells Fargo, they want to sign. There's really a lot of unhappiness with Wells Fargo and with the city having its money there. So, and we, you know, we've talked about the reasons, and we've shown you some letters and so on. And we wanted to invite you to come to the rally that we're having outside of City Hall this Thursday from 4:30 to 6 to give your decision on whether the city will be moving its money. We're not asking you to move the money immediately, but we would like the city to make a decision on that.
I can ask the caller, Wells Fargo Funds is, I think, one of the main funders of the pipeline that is going to run through the Black Rock Reservation in North Dakota, and I believe part of South Dakota as well, which the argument is that it's taking away native land that they're supposed to keep, that it's also going to be environmentally destructive. It's going to go maybe poison their water. There were standoffs with the police a few months ago, and that the Obama administration had made a decision to put that on hold. The Trump administration embraced it, but there have been newer decisions putting on hold. Is that accurate?
That's mostly accurate. The main concern has been not taking of land. Well, the land was taken, you know, last century, but or in the 1800s, but it's the contamination of their water. The slogan was "Water is life," Winnemikoni, Wichoni, and But Wells Fargo funds other dirty pipelines, and they've been fined hundreds of millions of dollars for discriminating against their own Black and Latino mortgage holders, and they, you know, created 2 million fake accounts for their own customers, and then started charging them fees. And then just last month, there was another scandal, because I guess that Wells Fargo doesn't learn from its mistakes, where they there was an issue of requiring customers to buy auto insurance when they didn't need it. And then there was a repossession of thousands of cars, and even more people, you know, had their credit ruined. I mean, it's pretty egregious. So
okay, so let's let the mayor get a chance to answer that. So you're going to have a rally, you said 4:30 on Thursday. Is that on Church Street?
It's right in front of City Hall, yes.
Okay.
Church Street.
Well, thank you very much for calling into Mayor Mundo's. So, Mayor Harp, what's the response?
Sure. You know, I have seen their petitions, and I have had a meeting with our controller to determine what it is that we can do. Now, I guess Wells Fargo is a large bank with a lot of capacity. As a result, we would have to find another bank that has the same capacity that Wells Fargo has, according to our controller. And so we're going to begin to remove some of our resources out, but we would destabilize the city financially if we just pulled everything out just within a few days or a few months. And so he is studying it now and trying to figure out a way to planfully remove the dollars that we have there. And as he can, he is removing dollars that may be in certain accounts that we don't need. But it is our active account, and it will take some doing to find another bank that has the same capacity.
What does capacity mean? Does that mean get the right kind of interest rate, or to handle the deposits in
well,
and out, to float bonds? What is it, the kind of capacity?
I think that it means that, one, it's a lot of money, and so they have to have the ability to handle millions upon millions of dollars. The other thing is that, and I think that's it more than they do our paychecks. They do a lot of our work, and it's all been mechanized. And to set something up with someone else will just take time.
And how are you going to make sure that the next institution, I mean, I do think pretty much every big bank is evil. This is my personal opinion. Okay. How do you do that?
Well, you know, we're going to look, and we're going to try to see if there's a big enough bank that it has is the least evil. You know, that's all we can do.
And how much do we have in Wells Fargo?
I mean, it's millions of dollars. You know, our budget is over almost $539 million. So, you know, a lot of that money runs through that bank.
All right. Well, thank you so much for the call, 287. And you're listening to 103.5 FM, WNHH, your home for community radio. We're doing Mayor Monday with Mayor Harv. A lot of questions today. We got a Facebook now. We got one on call, one on text, one on Facebook. I guess this is the new media era, but we still call it radio. Tom writes in.
Some people call it newspapers.
That's right. This is what a newspaper is now. But our fingers aren't getting dirty from the ink. Tom asks, can you give us an update on how the state's lack of a budget has affected city finances and services to date? And what's the latest with the city's preparations in case the state does not pass a budget by end of September? Thank you very much for the question, Tom.
So, thank you, Tom. What we have done is that we have done a semi-freeze on hiring. We're still going to hire police and fire. We have also done a hold on most of our contracts, but if they're contracts that impact public safety, like contracts for our homeless shelters and that sort of thing, we're going to move forward with those contracts. But by and large, we're pretty much at a standstill in terms of contracts, in terms of hiring, and we're hoping that that will save some money. We're basically hoping that by the end of September there will be a budget. We were saved somewhat. We were able to open school because we were really concerned about that, because we were one of the communities that received our educational cost sharing, or will receive it, or due to receive it.
The governor announced that he's cutting state aid to education for everybody pretty much but the bigger cities, and we're going to get the same amount we got last year.
Right, and so at the beginning of October, we expect to get those dollars, and so that will help. Otherwise, we would have been in a pretty bad way towards the middle of October. I think that we'll be able to hold off without hiring, without contracts, until November sometime. My understanding is that it's already taken longer to get a budget this year than it did during the income tax fight at the General Assembly.
Wow. That was an ugly fight.
Yeah. And yet they were able to get a budget.
You weren't up there yet, but we all remember it.
Yes.
I was 91 and you were 92. You were,
right. Yeah.
And so one question is, the school did open, and we never talked the way some other communities have talked about having fewer school days. The state says you have to have 180 school days, correct? And sometimes just to make that work, school districts have you come in for an hour or something, you know, when no one shows up. But the state doesn't necessarily fund those 180 days, correct? I mean, is that an accurate way of putting it?
Sure. I mean, the state only funds a portion. It's called educational cost sharing. So a lot of the, depending upon the community, a lot of what funds schools is your local tax dollars. As I said before, in New Haven, about 25% of our local tax dollars goes to education. Most of it comes from state grants, not all of it from ECS or educational cost sharing. Some of it comes from the dollars that we get for magnet schools, their priority school funding that we get, and we get Title I money from the federal government. And many other sources of funding, so that just 25% comes from our local taxpayers.
Mm-hmm. And so this week, besides the city schools opening, and tonight's the Board of Ed, anything big coming up tonight at the Board of Ed?
Well, you know, I'm sure that the Board of Ed will be hiring teachers to make sure that they have adequate teachers.
And we did some hiring last week, too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And any big hot-button educational policy issues coming up this year?
I can't think of any. The most important thing is the hiring of a new superintendent.
Right. And we're saying now that might be mid-October. Is that what
you mean? You know, actually, you're going to have to talk to Mr. Goldson, who is chairman
Darnell
of that
Goldson,
committee.
Darnell Goldson, Board of Ed member.
Right.
Maybe the husband of the next Alder in West Rock, if one out of the three candidates. Can you believe there are three people running for Alder in West Rock? I don't know if three people even vote in that ward. But But it's an interesting race.
It is one of the lower voter turnout. You got
Michelle Edmonds-Sepulveda, who used to be on the board. And, you know, there are actually three family kind of dynasty connections there. So Michelle Edmonds-Sepulveda is the daughter of Reverend Edmonds, who was the...
No, she's not.
Oh, she's not?
No, no.
Doesn't she have a relationship?
No.
There's no tie to Edmonds? I always thought she was an
Edmonds. No, I mean, she is an Edmonds, but it's
just through marriage?
Nope. Her last name was Edmonds. I think that there may be a possible relationship, but I've never heard that.
Oh, okay. So I stand corrected. Anyway, yeah. She's someone who has a following at the base. She grew up in a street with, I think, 20 relatives on one street on Creek Road there. So she's really ruined that neighborhood, one group. Mm-hmm. Then you have Darnell Goldson, Tasha Goldson, who's going to be running. And Darnell Goldson used to be the alder there,
mm-hmm.
has his own set of connections of people on the West Rock side, I believe. Michelle is on the West Hills side because that's a district that's, it's an interesting ward, as you know, is divided by West Rock.
Right.
You can't just walk through West Rock. I remember once people used to talk about, actors used to talk about trying to build a tunnel through West Rock to connect them.
And two voting places.
And two voting places, which really makes it even harder and a lot of money to do. Mm-hmm. And then the third, there's a Delgado, Charlie Delgado. He's 23 years old, I think. He's running. And he's pretty fired up. He grew up around there as well. Mm-hmm. He went to, I believe, Southern. And he's connected to New Haven Rising, which is connected to the Yale Union. So if you wondered when Unite Here, the Yale Union is the most important vote-gathering force in the city. They haven't been showing up much in this election. They're not even running anyone in Ward 1. But I'm wondering whether they're going to show up for this guy. And in fact, we're going to see three citywide forces or three kind of camps doing a battle in this one out-of-the-way ward.
It'll be interesting to see.
Do you have a candidate you're supporting?
I'm supporting Michelle Sepulveda.
And what's the reason?
Well, I've known her for many, many years. I know that she's committed to this city, to the community where she lives. She's also works with our young people at Hill House, and I think she's a great citizen. She also has experience on the Board of Alders, so that you know, she won't have to learn on the job. So I think she'll be great.
She, I've known her about a couple of decades. She's always been doing stuff for kids. I remember she was at the, I forget what the name of the school was then. That's at right behind the Sergeant Drive and Jordan's Furniture.
Oh, okay.
That's now New Horizons. But
right.
It used to be a younger kids' school. And she used to do a dance program there in the community. She always was doing sort of arts and kids and stuff.
She also worked at Dixwell Community Arts Center, and my kids went there after school, and she taught them dance.
Really? That's a long time ago. I mean, your kids went to school 20 years or more ago, right?
Yeah.
And so, where was the Dixwell Arts Center?
It was right over in Dixwell United Church of Christ in the basement.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And your kids danced?
My kids danced. And, you know, believe it or not, Tony Walker was the director.
Tony Edmonds Walker.
Yes.
And she is an Edmonds.
She is an Edmonds.
All right.
And Michelle Edmonds was, and her sister, I think it's Maya, were both dancers at the time, phenomenal dancers, and they taught kids after school.
So you went to dance recitals?
I did.
You're a dance recital mom?
I did.
Yes. I have a hard time connecting with dance.
Why?
I don't know why. You know how it's different art forms? Like, I don't connect to opera.
Really?
But I do. I love music. I love art. I love, you know, theater. I don't know what it is about dance. You like dance? You like?
Oh, I love dance.
I mean, it's beautiful.
I love it. And it really connects with you in a real spiritual way. I love the fact that now in so many churches that they have
I've
dance.
Been noticing that in recent years.
Yeah.
They have young people kind of dancing up and down the aisles to the music.
Yeah. And, you know, and it connects your body to, you know, like the spirit of the music. And I know that may sound a little crazy.
No, it makes total sense. No, I get intellectually why dance is a powerful art form, because it's a form of expression that's very natural. It comes out of your body. It connects with your other senses. It expresses something in a way that's other than words.
Yeah,
it just never worked for me. I don't know why.
I'm
glad it works for you. Yeah.
Everybody's different, Paul.
So some people love tennis. You were at the Connecticut Open. How'd it go this year?
It was great. You know, I normally do a women's luncheon there for women leaders in our state, actually, from throughout the region, mostly, but, you know, some come from you know, far away. And so I thought it was a great luncheon. I think there were over 150 women there, and they enjoyed tennis. And, you know, the interesting thing about that luncheon, Ann Wooster, the tennis director, the tournament director, always brings a tennis player up to meet the women to talk about what it's like to be a tennis player. And every single person that she's brought to that group over the past 4 years has won the Open. And so even this young woman, she
sounds
was
like the fix is in. The conspiracy. If Joe Ugly were here, there would be a conspiracy going
There's
on.
There's a conspiracy. And, you know, the young woman who won this year, also, she wasn't, I don't think, even favored. She'd never won a tournament ever in her life.
And she won.
And she won.
Oh, my goodness.
And it was the longest match in the whole WTA.
Was that Saturday night?
Yes.
Were you there?
I was there.
That must have been fun.
It was really fun.
The weather was great, right?
The weather was
phenomenal.
I mean,
nighttime at the tennis stadium, whether it's a concert in the old days or tennis, that is the time to be there. You don't have a hot sun beating down on you, and it's just beautiful, wide open space.
It was really, really, really
clean.
Lovely. And, you know, look, it was not anything, there was no fix in. She had to earn that one. She worked really hard.
I wonder, though, whether Ann Wooster has a gut. Like, in other words, she's worked in tennis so long. I wonder if she kind of spots the talent.
Maybe she does. Yeah.
And your women's luncheon was promoting how women have advanced not just in tennis, but in politics and business, in civic life. And part of the theme this year, according to Markeisha Rix's article in the event, was the work left to be done.
Yes,
where women haven't gone.
Right. There's a lot of discussion about where we haven't gone. You know, our incomes are still below men's. And, you know, we still need assistance in developing our own small businesses. We also recognize two small businesses owners, one of which I think you know, Norma Rodriguez for Lovas, and another was a company that is out of New Britain, because I do it with Commissioner Smith from the Department of Economic and Community Development. And this was a company, and I'm blocking on the name, but the head of the company was a Polish immigrant, came here and decided and was able to build a company very much like those that he'd worked for in manufacturing. And so they do a lot of work on the supply chain for United Technologies, and he worked there with his wife. And, you know, he was able to send his kids to college and done really well. And then he died. And his wife and daughter ended up taking over the company, and they've done really, really well. And so they were recognized by Commissioner Smith. And then we recognized Norma Rodriguez for what she's been able to do with Lavas. It started out as a local paper and now is statewide, and I think it is even in some adjoining states.
Yes,
so.
Massachusetts, Springfield. Yeah. So I was doing that whole time. I was looking up and get the woman's name. So I found the name of the other woman who won it, but there's no the other woman you recognize. There's no way I'm going to pronounce it.
Okay.
Maria Grzegorczyk.
Okay. Yeah.
Were you able to pronounce it when there? Did you have someone? Do you have like Lawrence or someone whisper the pronunciation to you?
That was Commissioner Smith's job.
Oh, good Commissioner. Grzegorczyk, and her daughter Dorothy Carlone, who run the Southington-based General Machine Company. So you're speaking up for women.
Yes, and for women business owners.
There's been that whole debate in Google when they had the internal memo from the engineer who was saying there's a reason more men than women have higher engineering jobs. And he wrote the memo saying it's from natural differences. And then he got fired and they said it was a PC thing. Just being a really interesting analysis of it, saying that he was very selective in what side, that there are recognized women and male differences, but in fact, often the differences would work in favor of women having those jobs, but because of institutionalized sexism, they don't get it. It's just been an interesting debate.
No, it is. And, you know, honestly, having raised girls and boys, you know, one of the things that you always think is that boys are just so much more capable than girls. And
that reinforces it, and that's how decisions are made.
And it really does. And, you know, in fact, they're pretty much even.
But you yourself have talked sometimes about traits. Not every man, every woman. There are so many exceptions, but often women listen better. I know that I will not go to a male doctor. I just feel like a woman, it is my experience enough over the year, they listen better and they're gentler. That doesn't mean there aren't gentle men who listen well. It doesn't mean there aren't women who are rough and kind of have their heads in other places. But what they're saying in this Google debate is not that there are no differences, but that it's a very complicated question and that that discussion could take away from the uncontested fact that there are sexist barriers.
Right.
So just an
instinct. And, you know, I mean, I think that there are, and this is going to get me into a lot of trouble, but
it's good. You're on radio. Don't worry.
I also think that, you know, like the whole idea of that we haven't really made as much progress in people changing their thought about what roles, appropriate roles are of people. And so a lot of times women don't think that they should go after the same kinds of things that they expect men to go after. And that most women, if you think about it, I mean, this is really going to get me in trouble. Most women who are even high functioning don't want to be the highest functioning person in the household. I know that is going to sound like, but I think that until women can say, well, if I'm talented, I can make the most money and I won't demean my husband if he doesn't, then we're not going to get there. Because a lot of times women will not move forward because they don't want to outdo their spouse.
There's that pressure in households. I see it so often where I see couples where the woman is somewhat smart, like my household. No, I'm not joking. No, the woman's somewhat smarter.
Mm-hmm.
Or some households where the woman is more accomplished, but it's important within the household. The male almost feels like, I feel it's almost like caveman bested. You know, the man went out and killed the butter that you're going to eat for dinner. You know, the man tells the stories about his successes when the kids are around, when friends are around the table. Women don't seem to have that same need. I've seen exceptions for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But I just wonder what you were just saying, that sort of almost keeping the peace at home with this male need to have been a hero and have it, you know, sort of.
I mean, you're seeing more, especially with the younger couples, you're seeing more and more men follow their wives. You know, I meet couples every day where that happens, but
Mary Lou Oleski and Peter Webster, she gets the neat job. He does cool things, but she gets like the high profile,
right,
big job and moves from city to city and he goes. Yeah.
Yeah. And so you see it, but not as often. And I think that that's one of the things that holds women back. It's cultural.
It is. One statistic I saw in reading about this debate in Silicon Valley is when they started selling personal computers, that's when women started falling way behind in engineering hires. The computers were marketed to males, men and boys.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that interesting?
That is interesting.
Big debate, big question. Here's another question here sent in by email from Dan Weinberger, an assistant professor at Yale. He said he had sent this to you originally. Dear Mayor Harp, I walked through the green last night, at about 7 p.m., I was shocked by the condition of the space, with large groups of homeless people setting up camp, furniture and trash strewn everywhere, and a smell of urine in the air. I just finished talking up how great New Haven is to some out-of-gown guests before we walked through, and frankly, it is an embarrassment. As a faculty member at Yale, I spent a lot of time convincing potential students, researchers, and faculty members to move to New Haven to study or work. I'm a passionate defender of and advocate for the city, but the condition of the green and surrounding area is an embarrassment to us all. It makes it hard to convince potential residents or recent transplants that this is a place that they want to be. I understand accommodations need to be made for the homeless, but surely there's a sensible public policy solution that can ensure compassionate support for the homeless population while also restoring the green to the showpiece for the city it ought to be. Thank you for consideration of this issue.
No, we've been working on it since I've been mayor. The whole problem of the green and the relationship between the people on the green who are homeless, those who might be here because they're on methadone. I mean, it's a problem that...
Willimantic, we heard a few weeks ago. People come from Willimantic where there is care because the methadone clinics, that you have dirty urines or whatever.
Yeah. Right. And so it's a serious problem. One of the things that was done, and I've got to thank Ann Calabresi for this,
Sunrise
Cafe, absolutely. And I had a meeting with her over the summer, and one of the ideas that we have is that there should really be a day program for people close to downtown. And so I spoke to the bishop of the Episcopal Church that operates the St. James St. Paul's Church, where the Sunrise Cafe is, to see if we couldn't get some thinking together around having day programming there. Now, the thing that has come to my attention from the Community Services Administrator, Martha Okafor, is that the new state regulations having to do with how homeless shelters are funded with state funding actually militates against people wanting to go to shelters. And so that's
why is that? Because they can't come with their spouse or things like that?
They can't come with their spouse. They have to pay something, or they have to agree to be in some form of case management that sometimes homeless folks, depending upon what has driven them into homelessness, feels intrusive. And so they just don't want to do it. And so what we've seen, unfortunately, are people living in encampments. You could perhaps call the Green an encampment.
Although they don't have the same kind of encampments on the Green, obviously.
No, they don't.
Are right there.
The police
I know
are
that
there.
For police, that's a difficult situation. They're very mad. We've talked about this. They're very mad at the App Foundation about they feel people are just sent out as zombies onto the Green.
Yep.
And they're dealing with it. I mean, the Green is extremely safe. I mean, I feel very comfortable walking there all the time. I tell people my time to walk there. But there's no question that incidents happen because of so many people who are kind of inebriated in some form and hanging out there, especially at night.
And they're annoying more than anything else. Now, when we had we worked with and had a plan to deal with people who are on the Green, and they got ticketed, and in the mornings, the police would go around and they would wake people up and have them move along. And then we also had Project Green Thumb. And
what's that?
That was a project where we would get them once they did that and they weren't abiding by the law to actually do public service work to sort of make it up to the community. And there was a magistrate that was working with us on this issue from the state of Connecticut and was very good at working through this whole issue. And, you know, frankly, we haven't had the same cooperation from the magistrate, the new magistrate there.
So it was happening. It's a little bit, are you looking maybe to bring that back?
Yes, absolutely. And try to see if we can get the folks over in the judicial system who helped us with this to take it seriously.
Great. All right. Well, I take it seriously that you were made time in your schedule to come to WNHA Studios for Mayor Monday. What a pleasure. Every Monday checking in with you, hearing what's going on with you and with our great city of New Haven.
Well, great. It's good to be here. See you next Monday.
See you. No, next Monday is Labor Day.
Oh, that's right. I won't see you. Yes, we get a day off.
But then I'll see you the Monday after.
That's right.
And I'll see you in between. Maybe you'll be opening some new nightclubs like Vanity. You did last week on Temple. So we have a big raging debate. Do hipsters go to nightclubs? 3/5 our commenter said hipster place. And other people said, see, 3/5, you know what you're talking about. No hipster would go to a nightclub. You want to weigh in on this boiling controversy?
Well, you know, I think that, no, I don't want to weigh in.
All right. There he is, a mayor ducking for cover when the tough questions come. Thanks for joining us today. I don't know the answer to that question either. But stay tuned to the comments section of New Haven Independent. Thanks for joining us today in Dateline New Haven. Thanks to Mayor Tony Hart. Thanks to Bertram Moses PC and Gateway Community College for providing financial support for today's show. We're going to take it out with this Afro-Semitic experience performing I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free from the CD A Plea for Peace. This is Paul Bass reminding us all that we do know what it feels like to be free. We just have to book our flight. Book your flight and fly free with us all day and all night long here at WNHH, New Haven's home for community radio.